Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, which you can hear around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Mitt Romney is bested in last weekend's Republican convention. What does that mean for the primary? Also, what does the GOP infighting at the convention mean for the party and its future? Plus, a preview of the Democratic convention taking place tomorrow, and the latest from the NBA playoffs. Can the Jazz clinch the series against the Thunder tonight at home? Joining me this morning, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Lee Davidson. Welcome, Lee.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Government reporter Taylor Anderson is here as well. Good morning, Taylor.
Morning, Roger.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke. Good morning, Robert. Thanks.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, you are invited to join this conversation as well with your questions and comments. You can call us. We are at 801-355-8255. Or you can post your comments and questions at sltrib.com. Lee Davidson, Mitt Romney could have come out of the convention that took place this past weekend and turned his attention to the general election if he could have just secured 60% of the delegates at that convention. That didn't happen, and in fact, Romney didn't even win in convention. How is it that that happened, Lee?
Well, Romney only won 49%. Mike Kennedy, a state senator, won 51%. Seems like he got caught up in a civil war going on with the Republicans. Conservatives and moderates have been fighting, largely over a new election law in Utah. It allows two paths to the ballot. One is through the caucus convention system. The other one is by collecting signatures. Romney decided to do both. He had collected signatures to ensure that he would go to the primary no matter what happened at convention. The other 11 Republicans running against him did not do that. And conservative delegates don't like people who collect signatures, and they tend to punish them. They don't like it because it reduces the power they have to choose nominees at convention. And that, in part, is what was happening.
Was it that simple? I mean, was it just that? Okay, you said in part. What's the other part of it, I guess, Lee?
A lot of things. Some conservatives don't think Romney's conservative enough. Others see him as sort of a carpetbagger, someone who's from out of state coming here. And there were some delaying tactics going on, and about one out of five delegates at the convention had actually left before the final vote. So some of his supporters may have left. I don't know that it would have made a difference.
And maybe also a good sort of performance in convention by Mike Kennedy, by this candidate. Maybe we should learn about who he is, Lee. Who is Mike Kennedy?
He's a state senator from Alpine. He's both a medical doctor and an attorney. He got his medical degree first, and as he was practicing as a doctor, he went to BYU Law School. He says he does some legal counseling. Has eight kids. Conservative guy. Been in the legislature, I think, 6 years. Most legislation he's passed has been related to health care. This year he made some headlines by being involved in helping organize a group to look into how to improve school safety and, stop school shootings.
Huh. That's interesting because that doesn't seem to play into the narrative of his being maybe more conservative. I mean, is he traditionally more conservative than a Mitt Romney character? And then what you're describing right there, that talking about dealing with school violence, gun violence, doesn't sound like something that would be favorable to far-right conservatives or delegates, I guess.
I went to a delegate meeting he had before the convention, and some folks raised that. They said, how can you do that? These were Second Amendment supporters, big gun rights supporters. And his reply was, well, gun supporters are part of the group looking at this. He said, I don't know how to stop school shootings, so the best thing to do is bring people together who may know how, and that includes Second Amendment people. And in his speech at the convention, he stressed that he was a supporter of the Second Amendment and that he has high ratings from the NRA. Whether he's more conservative or Romney, I don't know. Romney was trying to prove how conservative he was before the convention. He said he was more conservative than Trump on some things, such as immigration.
Maybe I'll bring Robert Gerke's voice in on this to ask that same question. I mean, is Kennedy running to the right of Romney? I mean, I guess just by going the convention route, he's doing
He absolutely is. And just a point on the Second Amendment thing, Mike Kennedy was pretty upfront when he articulated that none of the solutions or none of the things that they're going to look at are things that are going to deal with this or infringe on the Second Amendment. So they're not going to look at any gun control measures, basically. He buddied up to the Utah Gun Exchange people who are the people who organized the counter protest on the day that the high school students walked out of school. So when it comes to Second Amendment issues, I don't think we should conflate school safety with gun control or even any gun issues at all in Michael Kennedy's mind, because he's drawn a clear line between the two, in his mind at least. But he's running to the right of Romney, and he is appealing to the delegate, and sort of driving that wedge in between the signature gathering supporters, Mitt Romney, and the convention supporters who were there on Saturday.
Successfully,
yeah. And after 12 hours, as Lee mentioned, or after, I guess it was about 8 hours before we got to voting on the Senate race, a lot of these people had lives, and so they had went on to, you know, kids' soccer games. It was a lovely day outside, but we were stuck in there for the duration. So, yeah, I think... going in, you know, I wrote a column last week about how Romney might have a little bit of trouble going into the convention because there was this sort of undercurrent of animosity toward him. But I was a little surprised that he didn't come out ahead, at least. You know, the 51-49 was close. It would have been more appropriate maybe for Mitt Romney to get 47%. That would have been some poetic justice. But yeah, I think it was maybe a little bit of a disappointment for him. But at the same time, he was already on the primary ballot. By the signatures.
I feel like we should remind, just for the inside joke there, that the 47% reference is a secret video taken of Romney during his presidential campaign.
Yeah, thank you.
And who he was appealing to. Lee Davidson, you had a comment to make.
Well, you had also asked about Kennedy's performance at the convention. He did a few interesting things. He was handing out stones to delegates, kind of a reference that, you know, he's David, you know, to take on Goliath.
And was Goliath in this instance Mitt Romney?
Yes, but he also expanded that to say that the real Goliath is Washington, D.C., and he's the stone who would take on Washington, D.C. Huh. Ironically, Romney made the same kind of reference.
Yeah, he tipped his hand a little bit, I think, before the speech, and so Romney kind of tried to take the slingshot away from Mike Kennedy on that one and said that, you know, that none of the people he was running against are David, because David was anointed by God, and Mitt Romney is not Goliath, because Goliath is Washington, D.C. So that was I'm not sure that the metaphor necessarily
held
worked, yeah. But, you know.
And there was another moment when there was one of many delays, and the chairman of the Republican Party joked that, well, you know, delegates, why don't you stay after and help us clean up? And Mike Kennedy, not missing a beat, grabbed a broom and started sweeping up confetti on the convention floor, and his delegates loved that and were cheering.
Some antics.
And then at the very end of the night, when everyone's very tired and kind of sick of everything, Kennedy has a chance for his last second speech, and he just gets up and says, "I'm tired." And everyone cheers. He says, "You know what I'm really tired of? I'm tired of Washington, D.C., et cetera, send me." And yeah, he seemed to kind of clue into what.
Well, Mitt Romney's second speech was pretty weak. He's like, "You know who I am, and I'm going to vote for me, and I'll go get things done in D.C. just like the Utah Jazz are going to get things done tonight." Mm-hmm. And that was it. And then, you know, everybody was kind of a little, I think, surprised. I think he maybe had realized that he was not going to get the 60% no matter what he did. So just punch the, you know, check the box and go on to the primary.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join this conversation with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or posting them at sltrib.com. Robert Gerke, we've talked about this before, but delegates are kind of a different creature than your regular Republican voter. And it feels
you're
like we've
so
seen
polite.
This. Well, we've seen this all before, too. We've seen people get losing convention and then move on to the primary and fare much better. Is that what's going to happen here as well?
Yeah, I mean, there's a long history of this going, you know, I mean, you could go back further than 2010, but we had Tim Bridgewater, who beat Mike Lee at the convention, both of them beating Bob Bennett. And then Lee obviously went and won 2 years ago. We had Gary Herbert almost getting knocked out. Well, not knocked out. He gathered signatures. He would have been on the ballot anyway. But Jonathan Johnson beat him at the Republican convention 2 years ago. Last year we had Chris Herod, who you know, John Curtis finished fifth at that special election convention that they had, and Chris Herod won it, and then John Curtis beat him pretty soundly.
And that's happening again.
There's a disconnect of about 25 to 30%, frankly. It's if you look at those races, it's a pretty broad gap between where the delegates end up, the candidate the delegates end up picking, and the candidate that the Republican mainstream voters end up picking. And so this I anticipate will be just a repeat of that. I think you'll see Mitt Romney beat Mike Kennedy pretty soundly because, you know, Mitt Romney has a lot of money. Money matters more in primaries. Mitt Romney spent about $500,000 on the convention. Mike Kennedy spent, I think, $30,000. Something in that neighborhood. So, you know, but in a convention, you can overcome that. In a primary, you really have a hard time overcoming that monetary disadvantage and also the name recognition disadvantage, you know.
Did Romney comment on the fact that he lost in convention, Lee? I mean, did he say anything about that?
He thought it was because of delegates who didn't like signature gathering.
Hmm. And it wasn't just a matter of Mitt Romney having gone out and gathered signatures. He in 2014 was a very vocal supporter of Count My Vote, at that point an iteration of Count My Vote that would have done away with conventions completely. The dual path that we have now was actually the compromise in SB 54 that averted the whole Count My Vote thing. So when Mitt Romney came out in support of Count My Vote, it was to do away with the conventions entirely at that point. And he at that time said that, you know, conventions don't produce candidates who represent the mainstream voters. He said he's been pushing direct primaries across the country. He was asked about that at the convention. I was hanging around his booth beforehand, and his opinion, how he tried to explain that was that he said that in the presidential context, he felt like that the conventions don't necessarily apply. But he said he is recusing himself from the debate about signatures versus conventions, and it was a very standard Mitt Romney answer. If you've followed Mitt Romney in the past, he can be all things to, or tries to be all things to all people. And I don't think that necessarily went over well with the delegates. One other interesting thing before we move on, but Lee can talk a little bit about this too, but Jeremy Friedbaum, who was sort of a fringy candidate, used his speech to come out, and he said that somebody left something in the backstage, and he was wanting to one of his competitors, and he pulled out a carpet bag, and he opened it up, and he started reading quotes from Mitt Romney about how when he was running for Senate in Massachusetts, how he was pro-choice, you know, and how he was fine with gay couples adopting, and then Friedbaum, because Friedbaum is a little goofy, and it started going very homophobic, and, you know, saying, do we want the gays to adopt just like good Mormon couples, you know. And he ended up getting booed off stage. He overplayed the hand. But the carpetbagger thing was one that I heard from delegates before the convention. You know, they were saying, one guy said, we've got enough good candidates here in Utah without these elitists coming in from out of state. There was a sentiment among the delegates that Mitt Romney is overly moderate. Even, you know, some people compared him to Hillary Clinton. One guy said he's taking a page out of the Hillary playbook and finding a state to run for Senate where he thinks he can win, like Hillary did in New York. And he was just seen as too moderate among the delegates, which I think speaks both to the perception of Mitt Romney and also to the delegates themselves.
Well, and this is indicative of this split in the party, which, Lee, you wrote about as well. You spoke to some delegates at this convention, some first-time Republican delegates who hadn't recognized before going into the convention just how split the Republican Party was. And it sounds like, at least for one or two of them, they were a little bit disillusioned by that. Can you tell us about what they had to say, Lee?
Well, again, these were first-time delegates, and they didn't expect to spend all morning, afternoon, and night at the convention. And one of them runs a beauty college, and she says she has 100 young women who are often very quarrelsome, and she said the convention reminded her of that. And she said she was expecting better. And even party leaders said, well, now delegates see the split in the party at the high levels. And again, it goes back to the disagreements between conservatives and moderates, especially over the election law.
And again, just the basics of it, conservatives say that the caucus convention route was better because the signature gathering route did what? I mean, maybe can we get to the philosophy behind their opposition?
Their philosophy is it allows candidates who are not wealthy to run a campaign. because you can focus on a handful or a relatively small group of delegates and make your point to them. And they think delegates are highly educated voters, and they help winnow down the field to the truly good candidates. Moderates say, no, we want more choice, and we don't want just delegates deciding everything. We should let all people, all members of the party decide.
Yeah, I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, and we should move on to the Democratic convention here in just a little bit. But there's also this fight over whether to continue the lawsuits at the party level challenging this election law, and to some extent over party leadership itself in the GOP. Right. Can you tell us about that fight and what it means for the Republican Party?
Well, conservatives in the party have supported a lawsuit against this election law and used rules to call a special meeting of the Central Committee that was lightly attended, and a small group of the Central Committee essentially took control of the lawsuit away from the party chairman and continued the lawsuit. In short, the moderates say that a minority of the party is running things or trying to use rules to run things that they really shouldn't control because they're not the majority.
You also have the state party chairman, Rob Anderson, who's sort of under siege by this small group. And as Lee said, they kind of have taken control a little bit and really put him in a corner. And that's what precipitated a lot of the infighting on Saturday, is that the chairman forwarded some bylaws proposals to the convention that this group of state central committee members and delegates argued were not part of what was supposed to be on the agenda. They were not approved by the proper channels. So it was sort of arcane, but it turned into a lot of yelling. You know, the parliamentarian was being shouted down. She threatened to turn off people's microphones. She said to one of the hecklers, you must be a slow learner. And then she got chastised by a special ed teacher for, trying to denigrate slow learners. It was a real circus, and they spent about 3 hours debating before they even got the agenda adopted.
Normally, you take a quick vote to adopt the agenda and rules, but that debate went 3 hours.
Which I think, and then they ended up not considering any of those bylaws changes because they ran out of time.
Will this leave a lasting wound for the Republican Party? Does it really matter long term? Or question that I want to know is, will the election law survive?
Well, I think it will. Will SB 54 survive? I think so, and I think when Count My Vote, presumably it looks like it probably will get on the ballot, and I think probably will pass, and I think that sort of cements this election law. I think the future of the convention is a little uncertain. On Saturday, I was walking out of there thinking, well, maybe this was the last convention that meant anything, because why are candidates in the future, why are people like Mitt Romney or John Curtis going to go through the process of going to a convention so they can be embarrassed by the delegates and then go win a primary anyway? So I think for those candidates who are sort of have the resources, have the name recognition to do it, going through a primary makes sense. But again, I kind of have backed away from that a little bit, because I think in 2 years we're going to have a very crowded gubernatorial race, and you're going to have people like Jason Chaffetz and possibly Rob Bishop and Greg Hughes and Spencer Cox and Sean Reyes, and I think we're going to see a lot of those people who are still going to choose the convention route.
Only the convention route?
I think some might. I think Greg Hughes probably would, because I don't think he's going to have the money to compete with or the name recognition to compete with, say, a Spencer Cox or Jason Chaffetz. Chaffetz might, just because he's really well, and Bishop probably will, because Bishop hates to raise money and is well liked by the delegates. So I think you'll see a lot of top-tier candidates vying for that spot in 2 years. And then in 4 years, you've got Mike Lee coming back for re-election, presumably. And he's a darling of the convention system. And so I think, I think you could see some relevance for the conventions going forward, despite the antics that we saw on Saturday.
It doesn't sound like the rift then will get resolved. Lee, time heals all wounds, maybe not when it comes to this election law.
Well, that's what the governor said yesterday, actually. He thought time will help heal the wounds of the party.
They have to be a little careful, though, because in Colorado used to be a predominantly Republican state. The party got into one of these fights. and it turned it into a blue state, or probably a bluish purple state. The same thing happened in Nevada when the Tea Party kind of came in and took over, crashed the party, and Democrats have done well in that state since. And so I think there is some possible risk. I'm not saying Democrats are going to take over in Utah because we're more conservative than either of those states were before, but it does undermine the party's basic mission, which is to elect candidates.
Guys, we need to head to our first break of the show, but interesting conversation, and we'll see what happens in the future. I guess we'll see what happens in the primaries, first of all, in August?
June.
June
26th.
Thank you very much. We're going to head to our first break. When we come back, we'll turn our attention to the Democratic Convention happening this weekend. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in a moment.
Republicans control the presidency, the House, the Senate, most governorships, but many conservatives still feel like underdogs.
I'm tired of Hollywood spitting on us. I am tired of academia spitting on us. I'm tired of the news media spitting on us.
The mood on the political right, plus the latest on the Korea summit, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us today from 3 to 6:30 with Shalane Smith Needham on Utah Public Radio.
I'm Jay Allison, producer of the Moth Radio Hour, and I hope you'll join us for our show here on Utah Public Radio, with true personal stories told live without notes to standing room crowds around the world. Moth shows are renowned for the range of human experience they reveal. That's the Moth Radio Hour, Saturday evening at 6, right here on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government reporters Lee Davidson and Taylor Anderson and news columnist Robert Gerke. It is our Friday morning local news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or posting them to the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Taylor Anderson, to the Utah Democrats now, who are holding their convention this weekend. There are the big names, the names we already know, and these are Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams and County Councilwoman Jenny Wilson. But then there's a raft of lesser-known candidates, and I want to get to who they are specifically in a moment. But in a general sense, from your reporting on this, I got the feeling that these challengers are, for the most part, further to the left of McAdams and Wilson. Is that safe to say?
I think it's safe to say that McAdams is running in a Republican-leaning district that he's been pretty clear, you know, that he's running straight down the middle and he doesn't care. The campaign feels pretty confident that they've got the delegates on their side. Usually for both the Republican and the Democratic Party, you know, the delegates are you know, more conservative or more liberal, but he hasn't changed his game plan. You know, when they were doing the caucus organizing meetings at selecting delegates a few weeks back, McAdams kind of showed this. He, instead of going to his neighborhood caucus or staying in Salt Lake City, which is kind of the core of the liberal faction of the party, he was out on the west side of the valley. He was in West Jordan. He was in Taylorsville, where there were very few people at those. But he was saying, look, these are the people that I need to convince. I need to be a more, you know, moderate Democrat if he's going to knock off Mia Love. So,
you know, I want to get to the convention that's happening just tomorrow. But Robert Gerke, the strategy for Utah Democrats running for national office, at least in the past couple of decades, has been to run candidates who also appeal to Republicans to more moderates. I'm assuming that's still sort of the strategy among the power players in the Democratic Party. Is it the right strategy though?
Well, there are candidates who decide to run as progressive candidates, and those are candidates who lose in the state. The math doesn't work if you're going to try to run as an actual liberal Democrat. So we've seen Jim Matheson, we're seeing Ben McAdams, we've seen others who try to run this moderate Democratic strategy. When you've got a state that is probably the numbers are roughly, you know, about 20% Democrat, and then the rest are split between unaffiliated and Republican. You've got to appeal to those unaffiliated voters. You got to get an overwhelming majority of the unaffiliated voters, and then try to chip off some of the Republicans as well. So that's the only way you can put this coalition together to win an office. And so that's why Ben is trying to maintain this moderate stance. But we've seen it in the past where Jim Matheson, for example, goes into the Democratic convention and gets challenged for being too conservative. And, you know, we talk a lot about how the delegates at the Republican convention are more extreme and more conservative than the mainstream Republican voters. The same is absolutely true on the Democratic side. The delegates at the convention are more extreme and more liberal than the mainstream Democratic voters.
Which is what's interesting, because McAdams, again, they feel really confident. They think they're going to get 80% of the delegates and fly right to the general
election.
Yeah. He didn't collect signatures, so this is it for him. Otherwise, he's going to get forced into a primary. But talking to Alex Cragin, the director of the Democratic Party of Utah, you know, he was saying, you know, we're going to the Progressive Caucus. They're trying to get, like, younger, more progressive delegates to kind of lead the party. So I don't know if that's actually, you know, taking root or not. But McAdams, again, does not seem to be it's not phasing him at all.
Is there anything akin to the split happening in the GOP in the Democratic Party in Utah? Either Taylor or Robert want to comment on that?
There's not the same fight over trying to, you know, beat back SB 54 and the signature gathering path entirely. There is the split again between sort of the more progressive wing of the party and the moderates in the party, and those who like to win elections and those who like to, you know, pontificate.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, and I was at the Salt Lake County Democratic convention a couple weeks ago, and you know, you don't hear a mention of SB 54. You know, there's no lamenting about that law. People seem to be fine. They like to go there. The candidates like to interact with people who are engaged with politics. You know, you can go, and these are the people who really care, who, you know, they know who the candidates are, so they enjoy the experience, I think, for the most part. But we don't have hours of arguing over rules. We don't have hours of arguing over what the platform is going to be. I mean, there is debate, but that's the whole point of the thing. So
the Democratic Party, I mean, you spoke with Alex Cragin. They issued a press release saying that this was going to be a far more civil affair kind of thing, right?
They actually said that they would, for each hour under the Republican convention that the Democrats go, the leaders of the Democratic Party will do an hour of community service. So.
For a moment, let's focus in on that, the 4th District race that we were just kind of hinting at there, talking about Ben McAdams. This will be, as we said, a challenge to Congresswoman Mia Love. McAdams is the known quantity here. Who are the sort of lesser-known candidates? Who are the other candidates, Taylor Anderson?
There are four others, and the top two of them, I would say, are Darlene McDonald and Tom Taylor. And they are left of McAdams, so trying to get that liberal vote.
It's okay. Is it an uphill battle? I mean, you've got this has been a really, the general election has been one of the most hard fought in recent years, and the seat was most, when it was most recently held, I mean, it's the most recently held seat at the national level held by a Democrat in the state of Utah, and that was, as Robert Gerke said, Jim Matheson. He had to run again to the right of center for a Democrat to win. Let's veer away from this for just one second. I want to get Robert Gerke's opinion on something, which is this seat now, you know, conceivably, if you have Ben McAdams make it through the convention, vulnerable for Republicans?
I would say, based on what we've seen in special elections and around the country, if any of those tailwinds that Democrats are enjoying around the country are playing, you know, playing out in this district, I'd say it's very vulnerable. And it also, because Republicans are going to be defending so many seats around the country, I'm not sure they're going to have the resources to pour into this race. So, yeah, I mean, McAdams is sort of riding that blue wave, potentially, if he gets the nomination. But I also think that, you know, it would be a mistake for him to look past Saturday, because I don't think he wants a primary, because that takes, you know, 2 months out of his ability to campaign for the general. You know, and so I think he would like to come out of this convention with a decisive victory. I'm not sure it's going to happen, just because, again, we've seen the delegates in the past be more you know, adamant that they want to hear from. You know, Jim Matheson got called out for his abortion position, and that puts McAdams in a difficult spot if they do in the case of abortion, for example, because Mia Love has already been hammering McAdams on the issue of abortion. I assume she's got some polling where she sees that as a winning issue. I don't know exactly why. We haven't actually had a legitimate abortion debate in this country for quite some time, but that's the type of thing where it puts McAdams in a corner if he has to go into the convention or to a primary and get called out for being too moderate.
Well, the risk to McAdams also is to then try and appeal to the left flank of his party and then make himself vulnerable in the general election.
It's tough to sort of navigate that, and it can be done. I mean, we saw Jim Matheson do it, but the last thing you want to do is make it easier for Mia Love and give her some fodder for campaign ads by saying things about, you know, by having footage of Ben McAdams saying he's pro-choice. You know, that's it puts him in a difficult spot.
Is there any polling on? I mean, probably not. Actually, is the answer, but polling on the candidates who are running against McAdams or against the other known quantity who is Jenny Wilson.
Delegates are really hard to poll. You don't get real reliable numbers, and so there's not any.
Again, take it with a grain of salt because this is from McAdams' campaign, but they're thinking about 80% of the delegates are on their side. So that would be a clear victory that would send them to the general. But
okay.
I'll take the under on that. I don't think he gets 80%, but we'll see.
Taylor, let's focus in also on the Senate race. This is, people are already anointing Mitt Romney on the Republican side. But what if he got primaried and it was Mike Kennedy and Jenny? Maybe this is a question for Robert Kirky as well. Mike Kennedy and Jenny Wilson, assuming that Wilson secures the nomination on the Democratic side, would that give Wilson a better shot at this seat, Robert Kirky? He's looking at me with.
I want to make sure I understand the question. You're saying if Jenny Wilson comes out of convention.
Yeah, and if for some bizarre lightning strike, Mike Kennedy.
Oh, you mean if Mitt Romney is literally struck by lightning, and Mike Kennedy is the candidate? I think so. I think that's what she's hoping for. You know, not that he gets struck by lightning, but that Mike Kennedy somehow pulls this off. I think Jenny Wilson got into the race hoping she was going to run against Orrin Hatch.
Right.
And then Orrin Hatch got out, Mitt Romney got in. It was a big setback, I think, for her campaign. A Mike Kennedy Jenny Wilson race would be a totally different ballgame.
Would it not be easier for Jenny Wilson to also do what the Republican delegates did and say, hey, look, Romney's not from here, I am?
Yeah.
Would that not be an easier thing for her to pick up the David versus Goliath?
I just don't think that is going to hold water in the Romney is from out of state, and he's also very popular in Utah, yeah. Despite that.
Taylor, who are the candidates running against Jenny Wilson in convention tomorrow? I mean, are they also, I guess I'm assuming, to the left of her, the way that McAdams' challengers are to the left of him?
A little bit, yeah. It's hard to say. They haven't been as visible, but they are, I would say, left of Jenny. She has been fairly moderate.
This is sort of a broad question, and again, one for Robert Gerke, but something that we take for granted is that the Democrats don't fare well in Utah outside of Salt Lake County, Salt Lake City. And I know we've talked about this already a little bit, but maybe we can take a deeper look at why that's the case. Why don't Democrats fare well in Utah?
They don't.
I mean, traditional Republican state, but is there something deeper there?
Yeah, I don't think they speak rural Utah. I think they end up being, and I think in the past, a lot of times they've nominated bad candidates, the sort of the wine and cheese Wasatch Front Avenue set, that don't play well in rural Utah. The issues outside of the Wasatch Front are very different. And you also have this tension with the LDS Church. I think it's still a liability. They've tried to break through that a little bit. The Democrats have over the last number of years, but I think there's the Republican Party has been a lot better at attaching itself to the LDS Church and using that as its basis of support.
Lee Davidson, Democrats haven't always fared as poorly as they've fared in the past couple of decades here in the state of Utah at the national level.
Well, there were times when Utah was majority Democrat, but it's been a long, long time ago. During the Depression, for example, and even in the 60s, they held a majority of the congressional seats and state offices. maybe even into the 70s.
I think it was maybe in the early 80s. No, late 70s, probably, yeah. Right. Yeah.
But abortion was a key issue that, you know, the Democratic Party became pro-choice. A lot of Mormons had a tough time with that. Ronald Reagan helped. He was a former Democrat himself, and there were a lot of Reagan Democrats in the state, and they just kind of stayed more Republican or unaffiliated. It's to the point now that in the legislature, there are no Democratic legislators from outside of Salt Lake County. There was one in Price, Christine Watkins.
Right.
And then she changed parties. And she changed parties thinking that would help her, and then she got beat, and then she came back a couple of years later as a Republican and won.
One of the more interesting component, I mean, in this state, you know, Ogden, Weber County used to be a sort of a Democratic stronghold. It was more ethnically diverse, and over the years it's become just as more Republican or as Republican as much of the rest of the state. Lee mentioned, Carbon, Emory County, the coal belt, that used to be very pro-union. The unions have basically been broken down there, and the coal is
gone.
Coal has become a Republican issue now, and so they vote Republican. It's a tough road for a Democrat to win outside of Salt Lake County, outside of maybe, you know, Summit County, you know, that sort of place.
Taylor Anderson, just going back and maybe finishing this out to the Democratic convention happening tomorrow. Who are the delegates? I mean, you've got delegates coming from all of the places that Robert Gerke is just describing around the state. Do they? Are they? They're not uniform. They're probably a subset of people who are maybe have more labor concerns if they're coming from a different part of the state versus, I don't know, a different set of values if they're coming from Salt Lake City.
Yeah, it'll actually be pretty. And I think Robert kind of described it pretty well, where the issues outside of the Wasatch Front are very different. We've got a problem with growth here, whereas they've got a problem where they're shrinking almost everywhere else aside from Summit County and the kind of collar counties outside of the Wasatch Front. But those are the races. There are three legislative races. Two include Park City, and one includes Moab. And so it'll be interesting. This will be my first Democratic convention to see what issues they bring up, if they lament, you know, being part of these sweeping rural districts that include these liberal pockets like Moab and Park City. So it'll be interesting to see how those delegates differ from Salt Lake County delegates.
We will look for your reporting on the convention taking place tomorrow. That's Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Taylor Anderson. Let's take another quick break here, and when we come back, we will turn to Governor Herbert's position on the citizen ballot initiatives appearing on the November ballot. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Salt Lake Express, featuring daily shuttles to downtown Salt Lake and Salt Lake International Airport. Information on bookings available at saltlakeexpress.com.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and AARP Utah, a nonpartisan social change organization with a membership helping people 50 and over improve their lives by providing materials, programs, and advocacy on key issues. More information is available at aarp.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Lee Davidson, Taylor Anderson, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us by calling 801-355-8255. Guys, we need to save time for a conversation about the Utah Jazz and their prospects in tonight's Game 6 with Utah Jazz reporter Kyle Goon. But just for a few minutes, I want Lee Davidson to talk about Governor Gary Herbert's statements on the ballot initiatives that we are expecting to see this November. He's in favor of a couple, sort of, and opposed to a couple as well. Where does he come down on these initiatives there? Maybe we can start with medical marijuana, for example.
Well, that's one he opposes. The other one is expanding Medicaid. He has opposed medical marijuana in the past. He has a variety of reasons, but they boil down to he doesn't he thinks it might lead to recreational use.
Okay.
And he doesn't think that there's a lot of science that's proven what the correct doses should be, et cetera, and he thinks the science should come first and then the initiative. And he also points out that federal law outlaws marijuana use, and he says we shouldn't ignore that.
And he takes issue, I think, with how the initiative is written as well. Is that correct? Did I see that in your reporting? Maybe not.
He says there's a lot of loopholes. For example, if you live more than 100 miles away from a dispensary, you can grow your own. He says once you grow your own, you lose control of the whole issue. He doesn't like that a lot of different kinds of healthcare professionals could sign essentially permission to get medical marijuana. He thinks it should be just certain kinds of doctors and not nurse practitioners or others.
Polling shows wide support for medical marijuana among Utah residents. Will the governors coming out against this have much of an effect?
Actually, you might want to ask
Taylor Anderson.
Taylor, because
yeah, sure.
He covers that issue closely.
Yeah, I mean, the governor's opposition is kind of, it was the signal that's the first opposition campaign. It's again, it's yet to be seen if there's going to be a formal campaign that says just say no to this ballot initiative or not. But you know, you saw the governor come out, then the Utah Medical Association, the LDS Church, and I think that's going to be the campaign against it. We'll see
and
if people are going to.
The governor
check.
Said he may convene a group of experts mm-hmm. to talk about this and point out problems with it.
Let's move on to some of the other initiatives that he spoke about yesterday during his monthly news conference. You mentioned Medicaid expansion. He's opposed to that.
He's opposed to that. He thinks that a bill that the legislature passed is enough. It would cover about 70,000 more low-income Utahns up to those who earn at the poverty level or under. The initiative would cover people who earn up to 138% of poverty. It'd be 150,000 people instead of 72,000.
How's the polling on that? What do Utah residents say about that?
Our polling shows people favor it. It would cost them more money. Sales tax would go up about 3 cents for every $20 spent. Supporters of it say, however, that would bring in a lot of federal money, $800 million, to help pay for this stuff.
Federal money, by the way, that Utah taxpayers are already paying to the federal government and just not getting back right now because we've refused the money.
That's Robert Gerke. Just a couple of minutes, a minute left here to get through the other two. Lee Davidson, we've got the Independent Redistricting Commission.
He gave tepid support to that.
He
thinks that Republicans so far outnumber Democrats that you can't create a Democratic district without gerrymandering. Of course, Democrats disagree.
And then count my vote. This is sort of solidifying this election law that we've been talking about all hour long.
Right.
What did he say about that?
He said it's the current law, and it would improve the current law. It would make it easier to collect signatures and qualify for the ballot, so he favors it.
Okay. Guys, just to save time for this conversation about the Utah Jazz, we're going to have to now move to our final segment of the show, our underplayed stories of the week. And Lee Davidson, are you ready with one?
Sure. There's a story this morning, actually, saying that Jordan School District is going to raise salaries for teachers. When they did that last summer, they set off kind of a salary war across the Wasatch Front. Everybody started offering teachers more to try to attract them, and rural school districts complained that they were losing all their teachers. So it'll be interesting to see if this kicks off another battle like that.
Yeah, it will. Robert Gerke, your pick for underplayed story.
I feel like I'm always the obituary page, but I do want to. I think we should note the passing of two people, two Utahns. Sam Granato, Salt Lake County Councilman. Sam Granato died after a bout with cancer for the last several years. Sam, obviously, if you've eaten at Granato's, you know he's a businessman and very very talented one. And he passed away on Wednesday, I believe. Barbara Toomer, who was a disability rights advocate for a number of years, she actually in 1985 chained herself to a UTA bus to help protest them not having handicapped accessible buses. It was just one of many fights she fought and won to try to help improve the lot of life for Utah's disabled, and she passed away on Tuesday at the age of 88. And so those are two people I think our community are really going to miss.
Loss of a couple of giants from Robert Gerke for his pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. Taylor Anderson, your choice.
Yeah, one of our justice reporters, Mariah Noble, had a story about five Davis County deputies in the sheriff's office who were disciplined for sexually harassing six or seven female corrections workers, and obviously that's a big deal in itself, but there have been several big stories out of Davis County that I think the sheriff's going to have to start answering for, several audits and other disciplinary actions like this.
Mm-hmm. Okay, check it out at sltrib.com, and more reporting to come, I'm sure. I'm going to go with a follow-up to something that we covered on the show last week. A man and a woman visiting southern Utah last spring closed a corral gate. Tribune reporter, public lands reporter Brian Maffley reports that that led to felony charges being brought against them. Their lawyer was trying to get charges dismissed, but a judge ruled this week that they must face a jury trial and said that the woman's work with the conservation group the Great Old Broads for Wilderness shows that her intention was to kill the cattle behind the corral gate, a very literal instance of guilt by association here. If you heard the show last week, this will make a lot more sense to you. Anyways, check out Brian Maffley's reporting on this story, and you can do that at sltrib.com. Lee Davidson, Taylor Anderson, and Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for being here today.
Thank you. Go Jazz.
We're going to wrap up today with a look at the NBA playoffs. Tonight is game six of the first-round series between the Utah Jazz and Oklahoma City Thunder, and it's a game that for a time on Wednesday night seemed like it would be unnecessary. I spoke with Salt Lake Tribune Jazz reporter Kyle Goon to find out what happened and what the prospects are for the Jazz going forward. Kyle Goon, Salt Lake Tribune Jazz reporter, I can't think of a better place to start than to ask what happened on Wednesday night in Oklahoma City. In the third quarter, it looked like the Jazz were going to clinch this series. They had a 25-point lead against the Thunder. Where did that lead go, Kyle?
It's wild because, I was in Oklahoma City Wednesday night, and I don't know if I have a much better handle than you guys do, but, it certainly was surprising. You don't really see a Quinn Snyder coach team just kind of let everything snowball like that. But I think what it was just a combination of factors. You had Rudy Gobert and Derek Favors, two starters off the floor in foul trouble, guys playing a little more tentatively. I think there was a general sense among the Jazz that they had this thing in the bag, and I couldn't say the sentiment among fans was much different. It was interesting to me how quickly the crowd in Oklahoma City turned from basically booing their own team to chanting MVP every time Russell Westbrook was at the free throw line. So it was a pretty wild turnaround for everyone.
I'm wondering if you can comment on something else, which is that the series has been a bit brutal, and that's not exactly the right word.
Just chippy, I think, was what we're looking for, physical. Guys kind of getting each other's faces and maybe pushing a little bit and getting a little shovey. I think game four was really sort of the high point of that, where guys were getting pretty physical and there were seven technical fouls issued, which is, usually for kind of picking fights, more or less.
Plus you had Mitt Romney.
And you had Mitt Romney, of all people, wearing a jersey over a dress shirt, which, we could do a whole segment on that. But it was just kind of a wild scene, but I kind of did feel like the Jazz had the Thunder mentally beaten. That's usually a sign that, especially when a team is getting blown out and they start picking up fouls and getting into fights, it's usually a sign that they don't have much left in terms of answering with real basketball. So I had felt that going into game five, the Jazz had the mental edge. It played out that way for a half. They were up by 25 points, and what happened.
The mental edge, it went the other way, and it became kind of an aggregate thing where once they hadn't scored for a certain amount of time, and then once they were down, it just kept getting worse and worse and tough to watch. Money question for you, Kyle, is what's it going to take to win this evening?
I think that the things that the Jazz felt they really gave up, besides the foul trouble, they felt it was very correctable. They felt there were things that they've done all series. They've limited Russell Westbrook, who's one of the fastest players in the NBA, getting out ahead of the defense for baskets. They've really done a good job spreading the ball around and finding the open shot and hitting the open shot. And I think some of that died off a little bit, and I think that relates to the comfort level the Jazz had with their lead. So I think what they felt from last night, it was obviously a really tough thing. I'll be interested to see, how the Jazz handle it mentally, especially since one of their best players is a rookie. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think they felt like, listen, this isn't crazy stuff. It's very explainable. We got away from our principles. We got away from the things that won us three games in this series. If we get back to that, we can win, and I'll be at home where they've won the previous two games.
is it easier to get it done? I mean, on the home court, you have this sixth man, the Jazz fans being as loud as they are.
Undoubtedly. And honestly, game three, and perhaps you guys have seen pictures of the red, orange, and yellow, classic Jazz colors crowd, but it was really one of the loudest basketball games I've ever been to. And there were, that was not only my sentiment, that was the sentiment of several writers and several folks who, you know, have been around Utah for a long time and felt like, hey, this might be the loudest it's gotten since the 98 finals, the days of Karl Malone and John Stockton. So yeah. I will say there's a bond with the team this year that I think feels very genuine. I think, you know, my colleague Chris Camrani wrote about it early in the week, and it was an A1 story just about sort of the connection emotionally that fans are invested. And there was the little shrine outside Ken Sanders' rare books.
I heard somebody saying after the defeat Wednesday that Jazz fans had insulted the basketball gods by putting up the shrine, and that's why we had the 25-point lead. So I don't know if we need to go and take care of
this. Well, I don't know, but yeah. I would sense that there are going to be some prayers at the shrine today. So I think there's some people who have no other outlet. So, but I mean, it's just a sign of sort of the emotional connection some of the fans are making with some of the players, and there's not the tension that, you know, we described last time we were together about, you know, Gordon Hayward hanging over everything. You know, there's no worry about who's leaving, who's not. I mean, Derek Favors is going to be a free agent, but you know, that's sort of all in the future. He seems pretty bought in. So, I think there is sort of a connection, and the fans really have brought it at the home games.
And a click in the team as well, which kind of came out of nowhere, as you said, the last time we talked, leading up to the second half of the season. You'll be at the game tonight?
Yep. Yeah, I will be. I'll be writing off that 8:30 start. Oof.
Oh. Hey, if we win this series, we're probably facing Houston next. Right?
As long as the Jazz win tonight, or the game 7 would be on Sunday. They don't want that to happen, but the game 7 would be on Sunday. As long as the Jazz win between now and Sunday, they're going to face the Houston Rockets, who are the number one overall seed. The Rockets have beaten them in all four meetings in the regular season. They have their number pretty much right now, or at least in the regular season they did. They have the probable MVP in James Harden, who's led the league in scoring. Right. Chris Paul, who was in the series last year with the Clippers, and he gave them a bunch of problems. So, but that's, they have to worry about what's at hand before they worry about taking on that juggernaut.
At least one more win to get, and better to get it at home tonight. You want to hear my dad's analysis on this, Kyle Goode?
I would love to hear your dad's analysis.
He says the Jazz need to put the ball through that round thing.
That you know, that's good analysis. My dad actually, so my dad hasn't understood the concept of the beat writers don't cheer for the team.
Right.
So there was, I can't believe he even brought it up about Russell Westbrook's comment about Ricky Rubio. I'm going to shut that expletive off. My dad sent me a text after game three when Ricky Rubio had the triple-double. I loved it. I want to see more of that expletive. So dad analysis.
It's the best analysis.
The McDonough Goon father analysis. It's great.
I like it. You heard it here first on KCPW. Kyle Goon, Utah Jazz reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm going to say it. Go Jazz, and have a good game this evening. Well, not that you're going to have a game this evening. Whatever. That's Salt Lake Tribune, Utah Jazz reporter Kyle Goon. And that does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. A couple of people to thank here. KCPW's Jesse Ellis up at Utah Public Radio in Logan. Thanks to Tom Williams, Alyssa Roberts, and Spencer Holsey. And many thanks as well to the show's producer, Emily Means. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local shows at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Cafe Ibis Deli at 52 Federal Avenue in Logan, featuring triple certified coffee, espresso bar, and grab and go food items every day, Monday through Saturday, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., Sundays, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. Information at cafeibis.com.
A service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. This is Utah Public Radio. Heard online at upr.org. UPR is KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSUFM 91.5 Logan.